Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. Covering Islam in the Bible Belt is the subject of a conference to be held at the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center on the campus of Vanderbilt University in Nashville, August 21st through the 23rd. A McCormick Foundation grant of $40,000 is paying for journalists, religion experts, and others to discuss this very important and very timely topic, one which is of particular interest to Murfreesboro, but is of importance to the entire region, and indeed the entire country. The gentleman who wrote the grant proposal is with us today, Assistant Professor Phil Lubert of the College of Mass Communication. Thanks for being with us today.
Good morning, Jenna.
Good morning. Where did the topic idea come from? You found out from a colleague that the opportunity for these grants from the McCormick Foundation, which is based in Chicago and is named after the founder of the Chicago Tribune, were available. But how did you decide upon this particular issue?
Well, we were just looking at some of the major news stories that have happened in Murfreesboro, and certainly the largest story that has placed Murfreesboro on the national scene has been the mosque story. So, and we've been watching the quality of reporting surrounding that and other mosque issues around the country, and it seemed obvious that training in the background of what Islam is and some of these issues could be very helpful to a lot of journalists, especially those working in smaller newsrooms and media outlets in what's typically called the Bible Belt or in the South.
Will you be attempting to compare and contrast the way journalists in the Southeast have been covering Islam and topics pertaining to Islam with how it's been covered in the Northeast and other sections of the country?
To some degree, there will be one session that's actually will be a roundtable discussion with Wanda Lloyd, who's the editor of the Montgomery Advertiser, and Chris Peck, who is the editor of the Memphis Appeal. And what we're going to be asking them really is to talk a little bit about the Southern culture and the Southern psyche, what distinguishes the South as a region and how they respond to changes like the influx of Muslims and other cultures into the South.
It's been a relatively recent phenomenon in recent years, recent decades, for the South to grow demographically beyond Caucasians and African Americans, to experience an influx of Hispanics, an influx of Asians, and an influx of Muslims as well. From your perspective, is the issue one of lack of familiarity or deeply ingrained perspectives that don't mesh with reality, or a mixture of different types of things?
Well, it certainly appears to be a culture clash. As far as calling it an influx, the number of Muslims in this country is still very, very small. It's less than 1% of the entire population. And the number of Muslims in the Nashville area or in Tennessee is very, very small, even in Murfreesboro. There will only be one mosque, and up till now they've only had a small mosque, and now they finally have enough members to need a larger building, but still it's certainly a very small portion of the population. It's interesting that such a small group would attract so much attention from the rest of the population in Murfreesboro, and so that's one of the things we're going to be looking at, is what is it that has caused such a strong reaction to the simple building of a mosque. And so other issues we're looking at are where, and keeping in mind that this is training for journalists. So if you think about somebody who's covering this story here and where they're going to get their sources of information, they're going to be talking to different people on both sides of this issue. And some of the arguments against building the mosque come from certain sources that are actually from outside of Murfreesboro. There are people like, there's a lecturer called Bill Warner who has spoken at least once in Murfreesboro, and he is making the argument that, this is where the idea that Islam is not a religion is there are groups like this who are proposing this, and they're providing a lot of this, what is really misinformation about Islam, and it's being picked up. I mean, when you even had one of the gubernatorial candidates make this statement, and now one of the presidential candidates, Herb Cain, has even come out and said that Islam should not be treated as a religion.
The former CEO of Godfather's Pizza, who is running for the Republican nomination, who came to Murfreesboro and campaigned, and then subsequently made some statements on Fox News that rankled people, most notably Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison, the first elected Muslim in Congress. It has made Murfreesboro sort of a flashpoint. As a matter of fact, you might easily say that Mr. Cain came here to express his views specifically because of he knew that there would be a certain element who would welcome his remarks in light of the Islamic mosque controversy.
Exactly. So reporters are faced with, when they're trying to cover the story, they're getting these different versions of facts about Islam and about the Muslim culture. So what we would hope to provide in this conference is some solid background from religion experts and someone like Bill Warner, who's, that's his pen name, his real name is Bill French, is he describes himself as a religion expert. He's really not. He has no religious training. He'll admit that himself. We would hope to provide real facts about what Islam is. I mean, the whole argument that it's not a religion, the State Department has come out and said flatly, yes, it's a religion. There's 1.5 billion Muslims in the world. And to argue that it is a political movement is a little bit difficult. So, but if you're a reporter, you're being faced with these arguments. So you have to know how to deal with it and how to report this and how, and what do you say in your articles? Do you give credence to this argument? It's very difficult if you don't have any background. So hopefully we'll provide that level of education about what Islam really is, what different, what is the Muslim culture? Is it really a monolithic thing that's trying to take over the U.S. government? Is there any veracity to that? So these are topics that we'll be covering.
It'll be interesting to see whether or not the participants in the conference detect any difference in the quality of journalism coming out of the South's smaller towns and out of the South's larger urban areas, Atlanta, Charlotte, New Orleans, etc. Do you suspect that that might be the case, or do you have any finger on that pulse?
Well, just looking at the coverage now, you can see the level of difference. For example, at the Tennessean, they have an excellent religion reporter, Bob Smetana. In fact, he will be leading one of the sessions at this conference. And he has the time and the resources to pursue stories. And he's written a couple of series about the people who comprise the anti-Muslim groups. And also, you know, he's written on this topic fairly extensively. At smaller papers, even at the Murfreesboro paper, they don't have someone specialized in that with the knowledge and background that Bob has. So it's much more difficult for them to know the how to deal with the information they're getting from or the opinions they're getting from both sides.
It seems that 9/11 was the flashpoint for a great deal of Islamophobia in the country as a whole. You mentioned the Montgomery Advertiser. When I lived in Montgomery in the mid-1980s, I covered the official opening of the first mosque built in the state of Alabama from the ground up. There was already a mosque in Birmingham, but it was in an existing building that the congregants were renting. And when I covered the opening of this mosque in Montgomery, the contractor had his sign out front saying, built by so-and-so. We went in. We listened to prayers. We talked to the imam. There were no protests. There was no fuss. There certainly was no attempt to burn any equipment or anything of that nature, vandalize anything, as was in the case with the construction equipment at the Islamic mosque site here. So it seems that 9/11 has become a catalyst for a great many reactions out of ignorance or underlying emotions bubbling up to the surface.
Yes, precisely. It was 911 that is a catalyst. And it was part of our reasoning in proposing this topic, this being the 10th anniversary of 911. And the McCormick Foundation actually encouraged us to have this at this date in August so that it would precede the September 11th anniversary, so because there's going to be a lot of news coverage coming out of that. And it is the event that caused Americans to start believing that Islam is our enemy and that we're at war with all of Islam. So it's important, I think, especially at this time, to try and get the facts straight, to try and understand what Islam is, what Muslim cultures are. There's a lot of misperceptions. For example, there's a lot of people who think that Arabs and Islam are one and the same thing. In fact, in all the Muslim countries in the world, only 20% of them are Arab. The largest countries are Indonesia, Pakistan, and these countries comprise the most adherents of Islam.
And they are not all theocratic countries, as Saudi Arabia is, that some combined religion and secular for people who have been fostering the notion that Sharia law is going to take over the United States and replace our democratic form of government, whatever that means.
Yes, the argument that Sharia law is going to supplant U.S. law is being put forth as part of the arguments against Islam and against allowing the construction of mosques. Understanding what Sharia law, though, when you really start to learn about it, you see that it's also not a monolithic organization. There isn't any central Islam authority that determines what Sharia law is. It's different in every country. And it's more a reflection of that country's culture than anything that's written in the Quran or is preached by Islam. So this is certainly one of the issues that we would want to address in this conference, too, is an understanding, well, when Bill Ketron proposes a bill to which originally was to outlaw Sharia, and it's already happened in Oklahoma, what does this mean? And one of the arguments actually that Herb Cain made is that because Islam has a set of laws, that qualifies it as not being a religion, but rather a political movement. But when you actually look at all religions have some kind of law. You know, Christians have canonical law. The word Torah actually means law. So the notion that Islam is different because it has Sharia law is simply not true. It's simply a set of laws. And if you talk to Muslims, you're not going to find any of them saying that they're going to stop following U.S. law because they follow Sharia law. It's probably a massive mischaracterization of what it is.
Here we are almost 10 years on from 9/11. Why have we, the American people, and we, the American journalistic community, the American news media, indeed one might say to a lesser extent the international media, not gotten it right? We've had a decade to learn about what Islam really and truly is from Islamic scholars. Why are we still trailing the field, as it were?
Well, I think there's been some progress in understanding. Even going to war in Iraq taught most Americans that there are different versions of Islam. There are Sunnis and there are Shiites, something that undoubtedly most Americans had no knowledge of before that. So they're starting to learn, but obviously there's still a lot. And this is why we get back again to training journalists. They're certainly one of the key sources of this kind of information. And if journalists don't know the real background of what Sharia law is or the different kinds of Islam, then it's not going to get reported in their stories. So that's why we feel this is a valuable starting point.
What do you hope that the journalist and the other participants in this conference will get out of it more than anything else? You're going to be discussing this subject from a wide range of perspectives and with different nuances being explored. What is the one thing you hope they get out of it more than anything else?
Well, two things, actually. First, that they get the resources that they can call on when they have questions about things that they're told. And one of the advantages of a conference is that they actually get to meet these experts and each other, and they can make those connections. One of the things that we want to have as an outcome of the conference is to create a resource list and a resource page, and it actually is going to get posted as on the Poynter Institution's website. They have a feature called News U, which is a place which is designed specifically for journalists to get all kinds of resources and training. So they will make those connections, but at the same time, they're just going to get the basic facts right, hopefully. They'll have an understanding of the kinds of groups they're talking to, and they'll be able to place it all in perspective when they're being told something about Islam.
Sometimes I think that one reason journalists are hesitant to reach out for an expert opinion is precisely because of something you mentioned earlier, that Muslims, like African Americans or Asians or women or gays or any other group, are not an amorphous mass. They are as individual as individuals are. And I think they sometimes reporters hesitate to ask a particular individual to speak to a particular issue because they don't want to be perceived as, oh, here's my Jewish connection, here's my Muslim connection, here's my black who can speak for all African Americans, when in fact no particular African American can speak for all African Americans. And I think they concern themselves about possibly going for the easy target or insulting people in the process by doing that, when in fact what they're really looking for is expertise, not a one-stop shopping spokesperson.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And there's also always a feeling among journalists that they have to present both sides. So whenever they hear arguments coming from the anti-mosque group that, you know, they're being told that Islam is not a religion and that Sharia law has to be banned, they feel obligated to report that as one side of an argument, as valid as the other side. What really responsible journalism should be doing, though, is investigating the validity of these claims before just reporting them as a valid side of one argument. And hopefully this is what we'll accomplish, is that they'll a lot of these arguments are going to be shown to not really be factually correct. And then if they get certain facts and background straight, then they'll know whether this is really something they should be reporting or not.
In other words, objective journalism is not just reporting or reducing a story to he said, he said, or he said, she said, or she said, she said. It's doing a little fact-checking before you accept something whole hog so that you can ask questions on the spot. I think probably some journalists have are so pressured and so hurried, operating under deadline pressure, fewer people in the newsroom, everybody doing more with less, that fact-checking has become an after-the-fact in-depth enterprise that's reserved for the Sunday opinion pages, because the reporter does not have the resources either immediately at his disposal or in his own head to immediately ask the devil's advocate questions or the follow-up question to a response that does not strike him as right or does not pass the smell test to him. Well, is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think so. One of the most difficult comments to deal with is the kind of blanket assertion that there's going to be a certain amount of extremists within any Islam community, and that some of them will perform acts of terrorism, which is the argument for not allowing mosques to be built so that they do not foster terrorists. So how do you counter an argument like that? It's not anything that you can really fact check. It's actually kind of a prediction of the future. And there isn't any way to check out every Muslim in town and see whether they're a terrorist or not. Probably you could look at the record and see, well, they've been here for 30 years, there have been no terrorist acts,
yeah.
So probably not a lot of them. But still, how do you counter that argument? In fact, there was a CNN, Soledad O'Brien, did a segment, did a show on Murfreesboro a few months back. And what they tried to do, actually, was to try to, they wanted to present what they thought was a balanced point of view. So they interviewed both sides, and they pretty much gave equal weight to both sides. And even the conclusion of the program, they had one of the mosque opponents saying, well, maybe they're not terrorists, but what if I'm correct? Leaving this fear of paranoia where there's even a small chance that one of these are terrorists, therefore we shouldn't allow mosques to be built. But this is one of the sessions we're actually going to have is a discussion of First Amendment and religious freedom versus national security concerns. And when we were planning this, we were trying to get proponents of national security, of opponents of the mosque, to participate in this discussion, and none of them would come. We asked the ACLJ, which is the kind of the Christian conservative version of the ACLU. We asked Bill Ketron's staff if they'd send somebody, and all of them declined. So we didn't really get anybody. And so we made an effort to try to get them to present their argument, but none of them are willing to come and do this. But we will still have this discussion. Is there any validity to national security needs? Does this, however, would that be any reason to not build a mosque? That argument is very difficult to make, and there doesn't seem to be any statistical evidence to back that up. So that's one thing a reporter should look at. Well, if there are terrorists who are infiltrating the country through the Muslim community, and there have been a handful. There was the most prominent case was the young man who shot two army recruiters in
Fort Campbell.
In Fort Campbell, exactly. And he had gone to a mosque here briefly. So, but at one point, Glenn Beck had made the statement that probably 10% of all Muslims are terrorists. So if there are 1.5 billion Muslims in the world, that would make 150 million terrorists.
And, of course, there's no empirical study he was using to back up that statement. He just said it.
Throwing it out there, yeah.
Yeah.
But if you look at statistically, if there's 150 million terrorists, and if they all committed even one single act of terrorism in their life, that would be a lot of incidents, and we obviously don't have anywhere near that number. So that would indicate that there probably are extremists in this country and Muslim extremists, but they are a very, very small percentage. And as we've seen in this recent incident in Norway, extremism is not limited to Islam. It can happen in any religion. So to ban a religion simply on that basis, it's not supported statistically.
To what extent does the corporatization of today's media play into this whole attempt to, quote-unquote, be fair by presenting one side then the other side, even though one side is either terribly misinformed or is attempting to misinformed? I can almost hear the corporate lawyers coming down the corridor talking to the journalists, the managing editors, and so forth, and saying, must be careful.
That's probably true in some cases. In this case, it would seem, the chances of a lawsuit are not great. I think it's more, perhaps it's the fault of journalism schools, because this is kind of the lesson that you want to instill in your students, is you always have to be fair and balanced, that you always have to present both sides. Perhaps a lot of reporters are misunderstanding this lesson and thinking you present both sides regardless of whether one side is factually wrong or not. What you're actually supposed to be doing is presenting facts and allowing the reader to decide on their own. So I don't know if it's a fault of journalism schools or just this lesson got misconstrued that you should simply be reporting both sides of an issue. It's probably not a good lesson, and we have to do a better job of educating our journalists to just focus on facts.
Does journalism education Is journalism education partly to blame for the lack of resources or lack of knowledge about Islam on the part of journalists or about any subject because of an increasing emphasis or what seems to be an increasing emphasis on actually committing journalism rather than on the part of the undergraduate collegiate education that comes from the liberal arts and the humanities like sociology, psychology, political science that helps to develop the kind of critical thinking skills that one needs in order to be a good journalist, to think fast on one's feet, to have a little bit of knowledge about lots of different things?
Well, our program certainly, and any, I think, student at MTSU has to have a large amount of general education, education requirements. So I don't think that's a problem. They're actually encouraged. They actually have to have two minors. So we really do encourage students to have a broad education in a lot of fields. It does really come down to, I know when I was working in newspapers, it was always a little bit of a feeling of inadequacy on any story that we had to cover that, of course, we're not experts in it. And it's a different story every day. And there's no way you're going to be really well-versed in every single topic. Everything from politics to state laws, and suddenly the next day you're covering an environmental issue perhaps or a scientific story that you have absolutely no background in. You've got, you know, that day, you've got 8 hours to become an expert. And this is exactly the same for this issue. You have a lot of times general assignment reporters who have maybe just a few hours or even if they had all week, how do you become an expert in Islam? You simply can't. You don't even know where to begin. So it's always going to be, this is always going to be the shortfall of journalism as a whole. It's not going to be the source for the most expert opinions on any topic. Its main purpose, journalism, is principally to keep people apprised of the main events going on and around the world and to try to talk to the experts and get the facts straight. It's a very difficult job, and of course, journalists don't always get it right. So, and they haven't been getting it right in this story. So this is why Colonel McCormick established his foundation to actually try to address this particular problem and give reporters specialized training in specific topics so that they, when that, if it's going to be a topic that they're going to be addressing over and over, that they will be fairly well educated about it.
I think ABC, once upon a time, had a religion beat reporter. She lasted for about a year. Should the major networks have religion beat reporters the way they have health reporters and science beat reporters, the way newspapers have religion editors?
Well, I don't really know if... of course, the thing that's driving newsrooms right now is diminishing budgets and lack of resources. So I think, and talking to a lot of the religion writers as we were inviting people to this conference, it's this unfortunate situation you see in newsrooms and media outlets across the country. They're afraid for their jobs. When there are layoffs, these are some of the people who get laid off first because they're considered specialists and therefore less valuable. So asking newsrooms to start hiring religion experts is probably not going to happen unless the economics for news organizations turn around. That's a sad truth. You look at even the largest organizations like the New York Times, they're having to reduce their staffs rather than hire more people. So they're losing the ability to address these problems. It's an unfortunate situation with news coverage right now. There's really nothing we can do about it.
Are the resources that you're going to make a list of and make available to the participants at the conference going to help them in getting in touch with experts on a local level or just communicate with experts at a national level who can help them understand local situations?
Hopefully we'll be able to give them contacts on a national level. In fact, some of the presenters that we're going to have, we have Dr. Lawrence Pintack, who is the founder and dean of the Edward R. Murrow School of Journalism at Washington State University. He's going to be the first speaker, actually, Monday morning. And he, you know, by having him there, then all of these journalists will meet him. They'll be able to connect with him, ask him questions, and all the other experts that will be there. They'll have direct contact with him, and they get that will give them, I think, hopefully, connections to more and more people. And also, we'll have we have Asma Uddin, who is the founder of a website called altmuslimah.com. We have Osama Siblani, who is the editor of the Arab American News in Detroit. So these will also be people that they can connect with and ask them specific questions about the Muslim community, because these people are part of that community.
Will people from the local Islamic congregation be participating?
Yes, we're inviting a number of representatives of the Nashville community to sit in on as many of these sessions as they want, in fact. And on Tuesday, there's going to be a couple of workshops that will be specifically geared to help journalists improve their interviewing skills and story writing skills. And we will want representatives from the local Muslim community there for them to talk to, so that they can ask them specific questions about Islam and about their point of view of how they think that they've been covered in the media.
If any of your listeners have any questions about the conference, who do they get in contact with and how do they get in contact with them?
Yes, they can send an email to coveringislam@gmail.com, and we'll be glad to answer their questions.
Covering Islam in the Bible Belt, August 21 through 23, at the First Amendment Center in Nashville. Phil Lubert, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.